Now I return to the prophecy of Hosea. You've listened to a message that we gave some time ago as a sermon, but we felt it furnished a proper introduction to Hosea. This man is a remarkable prophet, and I personally do not like the classification of major and minor prophets. Actually, that was put in by the church, I suppose, about the 3rd century. It was not that way in the Hebrew Bible, and Hosea was just put with the other prophets and was not put last in the Old Testament. If they had waited until I got here to make an arrangement of the books of the Bible, I would have made the arrangement of putting the prophetic books with the historical books, the ones they belong with. And have you noted that practically all of the writing prophets, their message belongs to the divided kingdom? When the kings failed, God raised up prophets to speak to the nation. And these men, every one of them are outstanding. And just because some of them didn't write long prophecies, after all, you wouldn't want to call Elijah a minor prophet, would you? He'd be a mini-minor, because he never wrote any prophecy. If Elijah might be classified the first, John the Baptist, the last of the prophets, never wrote anything, and yet he was a prophet of God and announced the coming of the Savior. So that when we come here to the prophecy of Hosea, we're coming to one of the great books of the Bible. It actually belongs before Jeremiah. Hosea was contemporary with Isaiah and Micah, and also his compatriot in the northern kingdom, Joel. Hosea and Joel in the north, Isaiah and Micah in the southern kingdom. And this man Hosea would compare to Jeremiah. Jeremiah's the last prophet before the southern kingdom went into captivity. But over 100 years before that, Hosea had been the prophet in the northern kingdom, and he occupied the same position of warning the nation, and he did it with a broken heart. But his broken heart comes from an experience that he's had, and that's what we've been dealing with. You see, Jeremiah, his was personal, but nevertheless, it was more public. He loved his nation, and he was a tender-hearted man that broke his heart to have to give them a harsh message, but that's the kind of a man God chose. Now, I don't consider Hosea a tender-hearted man like Jeremiah, but this man had an experience, and as we've seen the past 2 days, he comes out of a broken home with a broken heart, and we're going into detail now into the text. And from that broken home and that broken heart, where a wife had been unfaithful to him and had become a harlot, he even loved her so much, he went back and took her again, and she played the harlot again. This man, with hot tears rushing down his cheeks, walks out before the nation, and he says, "I want to tell you how God feels about you, because I feel the same way. I've had a personal experience in my own home." And this man with a broken heart could speak to his nation, you see. Now, with that in mind, let's look here for just a few moments at the outline that we've made of this book. Very simple outline, actually, in just 2 major divisions. We have 14 chapters here, actually more than you have in the book of Daniel, yet we call this a minor prophet. And we have in the first 3 chapters that which is personal, and that's the prophet and his faithless wife, Gomer. It's the scandal of his home and the gossip of the town that we get in the first 3 chapters. Then we have the prophetic. It's the Lord and the faithless nation, Israel, from chapters 4 through 14. So now we come in chapter 1 to the marriage of Hosea and Gomer, the harlot. Let's read this as we move along. Verse 1 again, "The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." Now, these were the kings in the south at this particular time. And in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, king in the north. Now, you can't have them any worse than what we got here in the way of kings in the northern kingdom. Now we have the time given to us. Verse 2, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. This is the way that God approached the prophet, and it's a rather startling thing. And the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of harlotry, and children of harlotry, for the land hath committed great harlotry, departing from the Lord. Now, I highly recommend the Scofield Reference Bible. If you don't have one, you ought to get one. I still use the old one a great deal, but right now I have before me the new Scofield Reference, and I recommend it. Some people get the idea that those of us who use and recommend the Scofield Bible, that we feel like the notes are inspired. Now, just to show you that I don't believe they're inspired, I want to say I totally disagree with the first statement that you have here in the way of notes for this verse. And I'm reading the note. God did not command Hosea to take an immoral wife, but permitted him to carry out his desire to marry Gomer, warning him that she would be unfaithful and using the prophet's sad experience as a basis for the presentation of lessons about God's relation to Israel. Now, I consider this a very nice way to get God off of the hook. But you don't have to get him off the hook. He takes full responsibility for this. And the way I understand this is that the Lord said to Hosea, go. And my parents said that to me as a boy. Go someplace. Go to the store. Or go to school. I always interpreted that as a command. And I'm of the opinion that this is not just a permission, it's a command. Because this man Hosea, as we've said in the message that we've given, a young man there in the northern kingdom, probably in the Ephraim country, this beautiful girl that he met, he fell madly in love with her. And then she played the harlot, and naturally he wanted to put her aside. He wanted to marry her, but you wouldn't dare do it in a little town. And the Mosaic law said, stone her. What's he going to do? God says, go and marry her. And God's actually asking him to break the Mosaic law. Somebody says, well, that's terrible. Not when God says you to do it, friends. God said to him, Hosea, you are in love with her. Now you want to put her aside. I don't want you to put her aside. I want you to marry her. And he said that she's a wife of harlotry. She's played the harlot. And children of harlotry. Apparently there was a record in the family of that. Then he's going to make it clear to him at the beginning how he's going to use this in this prophet's life. He says, for the land, that is now the northern kingdom, hath committed great harlotry, departing from the Lord. Now, he's comparing that which is physical harlotry or physical adultery to that which is spiritual adultery or spiritual harlotry. And that you'll find is applicable to the believer today. You can play fast and loose with God, and you're nothing in the world but a harlot, a spiritual harlot in his sight. That's exactly the language that he uses, and God uses pretty plain language, and I could wish today the pulpit was a little stronger than it is. We are trying to be very nice today, all of us are, and as a result, we're not really sometimes as strong as the Word of God. Now, will you notice, we move on. Verse 3 now, of chapter 1 of Hosea, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, who conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and I will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. Now, we can see readily not only the marriage, but the children are going to present here a real spiritual lesson for the nation Israel. Jezreel is the name of the son, and it means God will scatter, and God will avenge the blood of Jezreel. Now, Jezreel is the name of a city. I've been through the ruins of it. And it's the name of a famous plain. I've been through that. I'm sure that many of you have. We call it Armageddon, actually. Esdraelon, the Valley of Esdraelon. And it has a long, bloody history in the past and still has and will have in the future. Now, this is a sign. God is going to scatter the northern kingdom. And you remember Isaiah's children had a spiritual message for the nation. Now I read verse 6. And she conceived again and bore a daughter, and God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah. Now, what does Lo-Ruhamah mean? And by the way, if you have a whole lot of daughters in your family and you've run out of names, I've got several suggestions to make to you, and here's one of them, Lo-Ruhamah. I don't know whether you'd want to use it or not, because it means unpitied. And this has a tremendous message. Listen to it. Call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. There's always been the question of whether it's possible for a person to step over a line and the grace of God not be able to reach them. And there are those that believe that you could never step over that line. And then there are those that believe that you can step over the line. Well, may I give you my viewpoint of it, and you can take my judgment for what it's worth. But I think the meaning is actually somewhere between. And this is what I mean, and I'm not trying to run with the hare and with the hounds both in this. But I do not believe you can ever get to a place where the grace of God couldn't reach down and touch you. They just don't get that low, that the grace of God can't go down and get you. But wait just a minute. You can keep on sinning in the face of the grace and mercy of God and keep turning it down and keep turning away from God as these people were doing. And there comes a day when you've stepped over a boundary. And it doesn't mean the grace of God can't reach you, but it does mean that there'll be nothing in you that the grace of God can lay hold of. Now, I think I've used this illustration recently about when I first came to Pasadena as pastor in a church here. That's been many years ago, back in about 1940. And shortly after I came here, a wife wanted me to go see her sick husband. He was at home and dying there. I went to see him, and I presented the gospel to him. She wanted me to, and he was a very polite man. He listened to me. He said, Dr. McGee, you know, I would say yes. I will accept Christ as my Savior. In fact, I'm going to do it. But he said, I want to tell you this. I have played and trifled with God all my life. I have been down to an altar 25 times. I have promised Him, and then I've turned from Him. And I've never been sincere. And I'll be honest with you. I can't tell you right now, when I tell you I'll accept Christ, whether I'm sincere or not. And all I could do at the funeral when I looked down at him could say under my breath, oh God, I hope he was sincere. I hope he really meant it. I hope the grace of God reached down and touched him. But you can trifle with God. This nation did, and the day came, God says, I'll no longer have mercy on you. And that day came. It was a tremendous day, by the way. Now he says, verse 7, but I will have mercy upon the house of Judah. Now, God said, I'm not ready yet to judge the house of Judah. Why? Well, for the sake of David. God said for the sake of David, he wouldn't divide the kingdom unto Solomon. He said for the sake of David again and again that he would save the southern kingdom. Well, may I say to you that somebody may want to criticize this and say that's not fair. Well, I don't know whether it's fair or not, but I thank God, friends, that God showed mercy to me and that he was patient and continued to show mercy, and he continues today to show mercy. He says, I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and I'll save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now, he says, I'm not going to save them by the fact that they've got phantom jets and atom bombs. I'm not going to save them by the means of arms. And if you want to read that story, it's a tremendous story of how God delivered these people. You'd have to go back into 1 Kings. No, you'd have to go to 2 Kings, the 19th chapter, and to Isaiah 37. You'll read how God miraculously delivered these people, the southern kingdom at this time. But he didn't deliver the northern kingdom. Now, will you notice verse 8? Now, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, takes about a couple years over in that country to wean a child, sometimes 3 years. She conceived and bore a son. Now, here's another son. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Now, if that was the only verse in the Bible, I would agree with the amillennialists today that God is through with the nation Israel. And I wish devoutly that even many of our premillennial brethren would quit reaching in and pulling a verse out here and a verse out there and saying this is being fulfilled. I challenge anybody to read the prophecy of Hosea and come up with an intelligent answer that says God is through with the nation Israel. Now, just read the next verse and we'll be clear on this. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And that's a marvelous thing. They have been decimated again and again by persecution. Think what Hitler did. And here's a marvelous prophecy that he's going to increase their number. And he says, and it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. God is not through with them. You just have to keep reading the Bible, friends, and don't pull one verse out. Now will you notice verse 11? Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together. The nation will come together. There's no 10 lost tribes, by the way. And appoint themselves one head. They don't have that, and they're not all in agreement, even over in Israel today, I can assure you. And they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. My, what a wonderful prophecy this is here. Now, actually, we have here five very wonderful prophecies concerning the nation Israel. It speaks of the fact that, first of all, there's going to be an increase in the population. And on several occasions, they've been practically exterminated as a people on the face of the earth. But they continue as a nation and as a people. This is for the future, and great blessing is promised for the future. Then he made it very clear to them here in the very place where it was said, you're not my people. Why, you're going to be the sons of the living God. That means there is coming, and the Bible speaks of it, the conversion of a nation in the future. That doesn't mean every Israelite, but it does mean that the nation as such, there'll be a great turning to God. And not only that, the southern and northern kingdoms and all the 12 tribes are to be joined together in one nation. And that's one thing you discover over there today in Israel. There is not the hegemony and the harmony that there should be. And as a result, it's a disturbance to the leaders over there. I take a Jewish journal, and the articles recently have dealt with that subject a great deal. But there's coming a day when they will be brought together, the 12 tribes and under one leader, by the way, which will be the Messiah, of course. And they're divided up over there today, as you know, in many parties. They are divided up like a railroad restaurant pie.